All war presupposes human weakness and seeks to exploit it. General Karl von Clausewitz, The Prussian Militarum of Ancient Terror, M2. Chapter 1. Pleos, atmospheric entry, check 2, minus 00, 15, 21. Kjarvik Stormcrow stood on the gunship's open hatch. One armored boot was on the lowering assault ramp, the extended hydraulics gripped in one wolf-clawed gauntlet. The braid of heavy orc knucklebones, strung through his long forelock, drummed wildly on his shoulder. His pelt whipped about behind him. The unfamiliar salts of an alien sea filled his nose and mouth. Before him was grey ocean, as far as his prodigiously enhanced senses and stupefying altitude could show it. Massive waves were capped with oily pollution and stuck through with scrap metal. It made them frothy and barbed, like watching the Hrynja herds on their winter exodus across the fjords. The phosphorus burn of auto-fire tracers stitched across the streaking blue, the loose chain rattle of machine cannons barely audible above the roar of turbofans. The penitent Roth descended hard and hammered left. A propeller-driven biplane with a lightning bolt jagging down the side droned by on the right and spat high-velocity slugs into the water. Kjarvik held on, scowling. More of the atmosphere fighters were buzzing low over the ocean on an intercept course. They were not going to make it. The Orc aircraft were remarkably capable given their ramshackle design, but they had not a scrap on the Thunderhawk's speed. And Aetherius, the Hawk Lord, was good, almost preternaturally good. His co-pilot was not too bad either. The gunship leveled out, autofire crisscrossing the sky around them. Kjarvik beheld the mountainous structure that Aetherius's evasive manoeuvres had brought into view. Bor would have called it an island hive, or the remains of one, but Bor had no soul. It was a titan of the ocean underworld, the burned, bombed-out skeleton of a thing that could not die. Its skin, partially regenerated with drift metal, plastic sheeting, and planks of wood, it reared up for the feast of metallics that glinted in the orbital band. Fat blimps and transorbitals buzzed around its thorny head like carrion birds. Massive guy ropes held the teetering mountain upright, anchored within the sprawling pontoon shanties that crested and fell with the waves. The relentless wave action was converted into power by salt-corroded copper converters, fed into hab-size capacitors for storage or through fat cables towards immense desalination complexes. The dark blue water was slurped out of the ocean by the kiloliter, potable water and salts spitting out into drums for export. Fleets of ramshackle paddleboats trawled the ocean for usable scrap. Mere months after Pleos had fallen, the Orcs had made their new conquest not just viable, but valuable. 20 seconds, came Aetherius's voice, tinny in his ear bead. An Orc fighter came apart in a blizzard of outsized engine parts, as Penitent Roth's las cannons neatly cut it out of the sky and set off its fuel tank. Debris spanked off the gunship's heavy hull armor, and Kjarvik ducked back to avoid a piece of propeller that came scything across like a circular saw and took a bite out of the foot of the ramp before bouncing clear. He looked back out and saw the fighter's wingman pull a turn that would have torn a lightning interceptor in half, then spear out left. Machine-guided underwing hardpoints tracked it, mass reactives spitting between its wobbling interwing struts as it flashed underneath the gunship, then pulled into a gravity-defying vertical corkscrew that swung the fighter-bomber in behind. Kjarvik caught a glimpse of the pilot. Immense musculature, bulked out in furs and squeezed into a cockpit. A huge grin split the Orc's ugly mouth beneath a set of red-lensed goggles as it mashed its firing toggles to send a stream of auto-fire gnawing through the Thunderhawk's blocky rear armor. A ruptured oxygen main sprayed compressed gases across the assault ramp as Kjarvik drew his bolt pistol and loosed a flurry of rounds. The gas spray cut out as Penitent Roth's spirit redirected her outlets. The wind cleared the ramp, and Kjarvik was able to watch as the fighter veered off with a mass reactive wound in her upper wing before breaking up in the water.
"Ha!" he roared. "Did you see that?"
"A lucky shot," Bohr chided, crackling in his ear.
"Better to be lucky than not, I say."
10 seconds.
The Thunderhawk responded to the heightened strain of 4 armored space marines moving towards its rear hatch with a barely audible whine of its already howling turbofans. Kjarvik looked over his shoulder. Baldurich pressed Phareos's shield into his gauntlets. It was white against the fresh black of his armor and bore the emblem of a writhing snake. Phareos, in turn, tossed the Black Templar his broadsword. Behind them, Zariel rammed the most vicious-looking weapon Kjarvik had ever seen across his back. He called it an eviscerator. The flesh tearer was massive, despite the fact he had just knelt to strap a bandolier of grenades over his thigh plate. Kjarvik had seen orcs smaller. Kill Team Umbra.
"Your helmet!"
Iron Father Joachim Bohr appeared from the cockpit hatch. Whipping mechadendrites performed final checks on his battleplate and moved, apparently guided by their own spirits, to pluck spare magazines and grenades from the equipment lockers. Other tendrils snaked through the cargo webbing, moving in a weird mirror fashion to the stride of his armored limbs. 2 women in bulky pressure suits, black-mounted grav harnesses and underwater rebreathers flanked him. Despite their protective coverings, their relative stature, the women possessed a presence that engulfed them all, that the Thunderhawk itself could not contain. They glided where the Iron Hand clumped, floated within a null singularity of their pariah physiology. Kjarvik gave a pantherish snarl and slid the black helmet over his mane, as advised. It found the gorget soft seals with a hiss of magnetic constrictors. It killed the wind, but it would take more than an environment seal to take the chill factor of the sisters away. After a moment, his helm display came alive, preset with counters clocking local, probable, and relativistic time. They were all blinking rapidly down towards 0.
5 seconds!
There was a time and a place for waiting. Kjarvik did not think that this was it. What was 5 seconds, anyway? He stepped backwards off the ramp. The wind hit him hard and he began to fall. The thunder of turbofans and heavy bolters disappeared in the roar. He spread his arms and legs wide and let go a howl of joy. The black paint of the gunship disappeared. The wide grey of the ocean rushed up to meet him, waves rearing up as though desperate to hit him before he hit them. Then they did, like being rammed in the chest by a razorback, and everything became black. Idolica, orbital, check 7, minus 000901. No one had ever called the Fist's exemplar homeworld beautiful. Its sun was a ball of thermonuclear rage. The Daylight Terminator was a line of fire 10 kilometers high and 20,000 long, a creeping barrage of photons and ultraviolet rays. Barren mountains rose high into the atmosphere, what wind the world's torturous spin could generate insufficient to blunt them. Vast black expanses of promethium sands covered about a third of the surface in lieu of liquid oceans. From the Storm Eagle's open rear hatch, Tyrus could pick out the sprawling extraction and refinery complexes, a web of rust and piping and sporadic flare-offs that ate into the littoral boundary. A countdown timer hovered over his left eye, stretched slightly by the curve of his visor. He turned from the hatch and stepped aside. The deliberate heel-up, disengage, toe-down maglock gait came as second nature. His own genetic proclivities, maybe, but the Raven Guard would always be more comfortable in the black.
Nubis! Antares!
The Salamander and Fist's exemplar of Kill Team Stalker clumped up to the hatch. The sun burned a white stripe along the smooth relief of their helmets, pauldrons, and the lift jets of their jump packs. They stood either side of a third figure, similarly geared with a light variant jump pack and grav lines. She was tall for a human, but not so tall in the company she kept. Her ornate high-collared armor appeared gold, but the thermal membrane that had been painted over the top dulled its shine. It stretched over her bald head and braided topknot, like a taut skin. The infinite depths of her eyes were shielded by a set of flare goggles.
Go!
Tyrus voxed. The two space marines pushed themselves through the hatch and into the thin, void boundary layer of the upper atmosphere. The sister followed, a second behind.
Next!
Vhagar and Yaros stepped up to the breach, a second woman similarly positioned between them. If Tyrus had once thought the mortal women in need of protection, then that misconception had been cleansed from him over the weeks of joint exercises and training. They were simply too valuable to go in first. Maglock though they were, Tyrus could picture the Doom Eagle shifting from foot to foot as he would in practice, eager to be away. He had come to know them all better than many of his own gene brothers, and he knew, therefore, that the Ultramarine would hesitate on the threshold and glance back.
I have an ill feeling about this, Brother Sergeant, said Yaros.
Tyrus glanced to the silent sister, felt his gut coil at the nothing that filled her space.
Don't we all?
We do not,
voxed Vhagar.
Go,
said Tyrus, lest the Doom Eagle jump alone, and once again the three warriors pushed themselves through the open hatch. Alone inside the coasting gunship's assault bay, Tyrus moved to the edge. He held a moment, heart swelling, eyes drinking in the view. There was no wind, no pull of air or ding of particulates hitting the fuselage, no howl of decompression, just inside, outside, and nothing but the liminal between them. Half an eye on his visor's countdown timer, he spread his arms, disengaged Maglock, and pitched forward. Sunlight hit him like a bolt round in the face. It overloaded his auto-senses and bleached his view to whites and greys. Bleeps and chimes alerted him to temperature and radiation warnings, failures in his suit's auspecs, box and power distribution subsystems. There was a reason that Antares cursed with a reference to bright skies. Work ceased. Cities were locked down. Even microbes could not exist on the planet's surface during its day. Which was why only a daylight raid would succeed. There was no sensation of falling at all. The air was too thin to be felt. The planet was so far below him that the passing seconds brought its features no closer. He could almost reach out and clasp a hemisphere in each gauntlet. If not for the madcap race of altimeter runes in his helmet display, he might have believed he flew. He could just about pick out the rest of his kill team through the radiation glare. They were far below him, free-falling, but still in formation and descending fast. He turned his head slightly and caught the Storm Eagle as it cushioned off the atmosphere and away. 20 meters of inertially propelled metal, unpowered, it might as well have been invisible. The precision calculation required to graze a body moving at 180,000 kilometers per second with another impelled towards it from a trillion kilometers away staggered him. It could only have been achieved with the cooperation of the Adeptus Mechanicus. He looked back to the planet. He scoured it for the coordinates of the Fist's exemplar fortress. Genhanced synapses lapped at the brink of the neural cascade that would trigger his jump pack as numerals raced across his helm display towards a string of zeros. It had to be all together, or it might as well be not at all. Soon, but not yet. Valhalla, Kalinin Trench, Check 3, minus 00-0335. Tulwey stood up on the bike's footpegs and looked back over the skull and triple-forked lightning emblem on his pauldron. The command salamander rumbled up through thick snow, pitted dozer blade ploughing up a great heap of it as if to bank up its own earthwork. Rattling caterpillar tracks threw fresh fall over the idling attack bikes of Kill Team Tigris as it pulled in. Its chassis trembled and growled, one big beast asserting dominance over the lesser vehicles that spat and whined around its armor skirts.
The one you were sent for is here, all right.
General Sebko of the Kalinin 303rd White Guard was swaddled in an ice camouflage greatcoat with a thick fur collar, gloves, a snow-speckled cap, and snow goggles. Only the pins on his cuff and the iron in his beard distinguished him from the junior staffers bustling about the command tank's exposed rear section.
The orcs are dug in deep and in numbers. It will be a slaughter, my lord.
Let the slaughter be your concern. The Lord Commander's quarry is ours.
Yes, Lord. The general had a shout to be heard, or if he was addressing one of his own unaugmented soldiers, he probably would have. Earthshaker batteries thumped and thundered. The shaking ground spilled snow into trenches where tens of thousands of heavy-coated soldiers tramped over squelching duckboards. Las guns in equivalent numbers crackled. Men shouted, tanks roared. Guns of every caliber voiced their frustration and spite. Hatred was as thick on the air as the slush in the bottom of the trenches, and every degree as bitter.
The army goes over on my signal, Tulwe roared.
He could hear over the din perfectly well. Shouting was out of consideration for the human's ears. The likely annihilation of the 303rd would leave Kalinin's northern approach wide open, but to the general's great credit, he simply saluted.
It will, my lord. A full-scale assault on the Orc lines will draw them out, and when they come...
He indicated the trio of black-painted attack bikes grizzling in the snow beside his. Spitting out promethium fumes and snowmelt alongside them were the lavishly baroque gold and black bikes of the Sisters of Silence. One of the sidecars was empty. It would not be so for the return ride. Tulwe clapped his gauntlets together.
We will wait for word of the Witchbreed's position and be on him like a winter gale.
Sebko smiled thinly.
Show it Valhalla's warmth.
Cleaning out the sidecar's heavy bolter beside Tulwe, Centaur gave an approving chuckle. The Valhallans' loathing of the Greenskins could have matched their own. Small wonder that their world held out, while forge worlds and garrison worlds with standing forces in the billions were ground under the Orc war machine like stones under the linked treads of a super-heavy tank. Tulwe looked to his left. The Dark Angel, Vehuel, throttled his engine, a challenge in his hooded eyes. He looked to his right. The soul drinker, Gregorus, looked back, gauntlet over his gear stick, the other on the throttle. Tulwe grinned in anticipation of the great race to come. A countdown timer scrolled down the left-hand side of his helm display.
Nearly, brothers.
And the countdown ended. Terra, Imperial Palace, check 0, minus 00-00-57. The Meridian Chamber, a little-known sub-annex of the Clanium Library, was where the fractal vagaries of Imperial time were charted and thus standardized. Here, seconds, minutes, and hours were ticked off, blinked away, their passage marked by the tens of thousands of asynchronous timepieces. The four walls were divided by the four outer segmenta, each one further subdivided by sector, by subsector, and for particularly prominent, heavily settled regions, by system. Muttering chrono-savants in dusky robes compared neighbouring pieces, meditated over astropath logs and shipping data, and where necessary made corrections, circled by joyful cherub seraphim. Here, Imperial Standard Time was set. Courland, Lord Commander of the Imperium, last of the Imperial Fists, stepped smartly out of the way as one of the hunchbacked Magi shuffled blindly across him. Its robes scuffed the floor. Hourglasses adorned with cyber-skull motifs and filled with grains of glass swayed from a belt of woven metal. The Magos approached the group of chanting acolytes that surrounded the Preceptor, the Master Chrono. A scuffled, leaden tank the size of a drop pod, delineating Terran time by atomic resonance, exactly as it had done for the last 30,000 years. The Magos' tools clicked and chittered over the venerable machine.
What is the verdict, Magos?
The adept took his time in answering. Imperial time was an arcane measure. It was fractal, ever-changeable. The unimaginable distances between worlds and the time-bending effects of warp travel rendered linearity subjective at best. But not so for the beast. His greatest strength, the Orc subspace propulsion technology, was also mankind's most glaring Stone Age strategic weakness. He could move from system to system at speeds greater than the warps. His lines of communication were instantaneous. Courland had but one chance to catch the Orcs unprepared.
The Death Watch assault on the Terran attack moon had required to the second timing. Accomplishing the same over interstellar distances was an exponential order of magnitude, more difficult. Fail, and he would never find them unprepared again. After a few seconds, in which hundreds of timepieces ticked out their own relativistic versions of time, the Chronomagos turned. His face was hooded, but clicked with moving parts.
There is a reasonable degree of probability that our times are now in synchrony.
Courland clenched one gauntleted fist and glanced over his shoulder. Maximus Thane stood in front of a clock-lined wall with arms crossed, garbed in a long surplice that was as severe as a statue's and grey as the genetic character of his eyes. He nodded once, and Courland made a smile, some of the tension he felt disappearing in it. Some, but not all. Everything rested on this.
The lords will be waiting. Call them into the library, brother.
Valhalla, Kalinin Trench, Check 3, 00000. Officers of the 303rd sounded out long blasts on their whistles, and Valhallan soldiers fixed bayonets, pushed wobbling trench ladders to the walls, and yelled, screams as formless as the steam that burst from their mouths. They began to climb. Squadrons of patched-up Lehman Russ tanks rattled forward in support on cleated tracks. Marauder fighter bombers, invisible in the blizzard, rumbled overhead. Tullway gunned his engine and allowed the attack bike to crunch slowly forward. He fingered his chain sword's activation stud impatiently, waiting for the signal, and watched as it began. Idolica, atmospheric entry, check 7, 00000. It began. A splutter of thrust arrested Tyrus's descent. The thrill of afterburners shivered through his armor. Then, nothing. He opened his arms and glided, no sound in his helmet but his own breath, the hiss of stabilizers. Solar radiation had killed Unit Vox, but every warrior knew his role. The atmosphere flared with short promethium burns as the others made use of their jump packs to correct their angles. The sun was ferocious, his visor seared to grey opacity. He could barely see the landing zone at all, the listing fortress of the Fist's Exemplar, but the greenskins would have had to shut down Auspex's grids and seal their shutters in preparation for the dawn. What was he? A charcoal speck in the daylight furnace, a mote invisible in the light, a streak on the white glare armorplast sky. He was the net, the knife. He was the raven. And the orcs would rue the day the Lord Commander had called his brothers to the war. Pleos, Mundus Trench, Check 2, 00000. Kjarvik's pack lights pierced the gloom of the oceanic trench to a distance of about 10 meters. Rust flakes and bits of debris, from fingernail size down, danced from the darkness of the water column in a reflective swirl for the passing of the beams. Depth indicator runes pulsed in his helm display, bleeding redly into the hyper-pressurized backdrop on the opposite side of the armor glass. Running across his path at roughly man-height was a ridge of dirt, pipes buried in sediment and planktonic xenoforms. Polyps and tendrils and silvery segmented creatures retreated from Kjarvik's light as though the sea floor were a living thing that recoiled from his touch. He clumped around. One of the Sisters of Silence lumbered towards him. Dozens of tiny indicator lights lit up her form and the shoal of escaping bubbles that rippled around her. Unlike the superb homeostatic systems of Kjarvik's power armor, her suit lost most of her exhaled gases with every breath. He could function at this depth for days, without food or rest if need be, but it had already taken them half an hour just to reach the bottom of the ocean trench. She probably had the same again, at best. Her hands moved in front of her, slowly, as though chained to great weights buried deep beneath the sea floor. "There is time," she gestured, using Adeptus Astartes' battle sign. She raised a sluggish gauntlet to point right along the run of pipes. Kjarvik blinked up a tri-dimensional grid map of the ocean bottom, overlaid with the runes of Umbra and flowing data screed. His eyes roved over it, absorbing it, metaconsciously. Hive Mundus's foundation levels were about 500 meters that way. It would be a hard half kilometer in power armor.
"Very well,"
he voxed, and then, on Umbra's shared frequency,
"Kjarvik, moving to target."
He started right, following the line of piping. The rest of the squad called in, Bohr, Zariel, Phareos, Balderich, a vox click from the second Sister of Silence. The tracker runes in his helm display confirmed their convergence on the target. The Sister followed cumbersomely behind him, breathing heavily into the vox as she struggled to keep to his pace. Pillows of dust rose languidly from the seabed with a stomp of his boots, his visibility dropping to 8 meters, then 6, then 3, a shoal of glittering particulates surrounding him like carnivores around a piece of meat. He continued on auger readings, the pipes always on his left. He glanced down for a moment to check the helmet-sized dish of ceramite casing that was maglocked to his hip. It was a melter mine. Its systems responded to his armor's auto-interrogator with a squirt of reassuringly passive signals. A double click on his vox channel pulled his attention back up. His pack beams slashed the dark with silver as he looked around. He snarled in frustration. The signal came again, click, click, as urgent as a non-vocal responder could be. A vow of tranquility was all to the good in your cloister. He disengaged his bolt pistol's holster seals, and the weapon came away in his gauntlet in a rush of air bubbles. He half-turned, head moving a fraction ahead of his weighted body, and saw it. A black shape, smooth, shiny like oil, cut his light beam in half. He stomped back, and it flashed by him, barely 2 meters from his face, more of it sweeping past as he pulled up his bolt pistol. His light flashed over the Leviathan's blubbery underbelly. Fins, webbed claws, weird, oily camouflage. His pistol fired with a thunderous boom. A compression wave rippled out ahead of the bolt, propellant burn frothing up the water in its wake. The second explosion came a split second later with a sudden blossom of red. The pressure held it together rather than allow it to disperse, and the ragged, heavier-than-water spill slowly sank. There was no cry of pain, no ultrasonic squeal of panic or alarm. Kjarvik watched it swim past, separating the billowing blood sac into smaller droplets with a parting swipe of its gargantuan tail fin. He had barely scratched it. A vox crackle spoke into his ear.
"Did you kill a fish, Brother Sergeant? First blood to me, Phareos."
"It only counts if you kill it," said Zariel.
"Are you using a secure squad link to keep tally?"
grumbled Balderich. Kjarvik did not think that the Black Templar liked him very much. The huge metal wall of Hive Mundus's exterior shell soaked up his light beam. It was a sheer cliff of adamantium composite, encrusted with organisms that had spent the last 5,000 years evolving to break it down. Kjarvik surveyed it quickly, beam nipping left, right, up, down, its visual appearance aligned with the schematics that the tech priests had released to Bohr. The deep ocean had shielded the Hive's foundations from the orbital strikes that had devastated the surface and given a base for the orcs to subsequently rebuild. But it had been weakened. Kjarvik could see the hairline fractures in the plating.
"Kjarvik, in position."
He uncoupled the melter mine from his hip suspensor and clamped it to the wall, voxing it in as he backed up to put some distance between himself and it. Four more confirmations came swiftly back.
"Detonation in three," vox bore.
Kjarvik turned to the Sister. Her blank face was illuminated by the cold square of lumen strips that outlined the edges of her pressure mask.
"Two."
He clasped the woman's wrist in his gauntlet. She turned to him questioningly, and he grinned. He was the Stormcrow, the unlucky.
"One."